Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Obadiah, 21 verses, hardly a book, not even a booklet, not even a short story. It's a journal entry, but it has stood Obadiah in future stead for over 2,000 years. More than 10 people in the Older Testament bear the same name, Obadiah, but I don't think any of them is identical with the prophet. We don't know who he is, so it makes it a little difficult to date and time the writing. Scholars' opinions vary all over the place about who this is. But the themes of the book are clear, and that's what we're going to deal with. And like so many prophets, it's not who he is that matters, but what he said that mattered. What matters is not who it is that's speaking, but what he is saying. That final summary word, the kingdom will be the Lord's, is the great hope, not only of Obadiah, or Obadiah, as some people say, but of every prophet, of every writer of the Bible, and of the author of the Bible, God himself. The kingdom will be the Lord's. That's where we're going. So I like that we got to that. Now we'll back up and see. So let me show you this. This is a map of Israel in the day, and you can see there's Galilee and the Dead Sea. Can you see that? And here is Edom, south of the Dead Sea. Edom means red. We call him Bluey in Australia because he's got red hair. Doesn't that make sense? In Bible days, they called him Red, Ruddy, and he was not a runt. He was a big, strong guy. Looked like a professional rugby league player. I mean, he was tough. And he sold his birthright, remember. What was his other name, given name? Esau. He was Jacob's twin brother. And Jacob got this section, and Esau got this section of land proportionment. You got it? There will be no test on this.
The tribe of Esau now are Edom.
Yeah, there are no Edomites. Nothing as a recognized people. That is one of the things about the Jewish people still existing that is so significant, because all the other peoples who were around, say, in 200 B.C. or 700 B.C. or 400 A.D., who lost their land, whether the ancient Greeks or Romans, whether it's the Assyrians or Babylonians or whoever, those peoples don't exist anymore. Only the Jewish people exist who've lost their land over two millennia, and we still exist as a people. Pretty remarkable. That may be miraculous. So that's where we are. That's what we're talking about. There's lots of other places in Israel, but that's what we're going to talk about. The theme of the book is the abuse of God's people, of God's land, and of the Temple Mount, or the Holy Hill in Jerusalem. The villain, the guilty party, ends up belittled, hated, and devastated. Obadiah is a book of recompense, restoration, and royal reign. That's the deliverance of the Jewish people. John Calvin wrote this in his preface to Obadiah. This prophecy does not consist of many oracles, nor of many sermons, as other prophecies, but it only denounces on the Edomians a near destruction. That's what he called them. In those days, that was the translation of Edomites. And then promises a restoration to the chosen people of God. But it threatens the Edomians for the sake of administering consolation to the chosen people. For it was a grievous and hard trial for the children of Jacob, an elect people, to see the posterity of Esau, who had been rejected by God, flourishing both in wealth and power. Here's the overview. I'll give you just three main sections. Verses 1 through 9, the future destruction of Edom. Verses 10 to 14, the reasons for judgment, the indictment form is lodged. And third, the day of the Lord and Israel's ultimate redemption or salvation. So first, the object of the prophet's hostility and his anger is Israel's twin brother, Esau, and his physical and spiritual seed, the children, the Edomians or the Edomites. Obadiah accuses Edom of, look at it in verse 10, look what the accusation is. It says, because of violence to your brother Jacob, you'll be covered with shame and cut off forever. This is not an isolated, one-off violence, but continual, repetitive, hostile, unrelenting violence. I think the Jewish Publication Society says, for the outrage to your brother Jacob, disgrace will engulf you and you'll perish forever. So this book, this one chapter book, could sound like this. It's a formal indictment of charges. Now I got this off the Queensland Consolidated Legal Acts today. 564, a form of indictment. An indictment is to be entitled with the name of the court in which it is presented and must, subject to the provisions hereinafter contained, set forth the offense with which the accused person is charged in such a manner, and with such particulars as to the alleged time and place of committing the offense, and as to the person, if any, alleged to be aggrieved. Don't you love legal language? So it says somebody has to be accused. We've got to know the time and date of it, and we've got to have an accusee, that is, someone who's bringing the charge, somebody to whom this was done. And as to the property, if any, in question, as may be necessary, to inform the accused person on the nature of the charge. So we have to have the accuser, the accused, the charge, and we have to have any property settlement that might be involved. That's from our dear friends up in Queensland. It's not very different than the New South Wales Acts, but I thought you might like it. Number two, if any circumstance of aggravation is intended to be relied upon, it must be charged in the indictment. 3 out of 4. It is sufficient to describe an offense in the words of this code or of the statute defining it. And finally, 4, the place of trial is to be named in the margin of the indictment. Every place that you have a legal system, you have a way to bring legal charges. The Bible is no different. This is a legal, formal charge against the Edomites. So they are going to be named. They're going to be named as to what they've been doing, how long they've been doing it, to whom they've been doing it. Property will be involved. You get the idea? The Bible informed our country and the government of Queensland into how to bring an indictment. We've got it right here in the book of Obadiah. So it's a formal indictment of charges against Edom as well as their accomplices. The indictment stipulates the most severe capital offenses with an equally severe sentence to be executed. So the indictment stipulates the severe capital offenses that Edom has done to the Jewish people. The crimes are horrible. One of the first questions you've got to ask when we deal with prophecy is it related to the people only of that day, or is it for future generations? Do you ever ask yourself that? You read the Bible, you say, well, this is good for the people of Edom and for the people of Obadiah, but we're 2,500 years on. What does that have to do with us? Let me show you this picture. This I took when I was in Scotland in August, and I'm not showing it to you so you can say, oh, wow, Bob was in Scotland. You can see I was standing here on top of a hill on a very high place above the road in the Isle of Skye on the west side of Scotland. And next to me was this hill, and across the vale was another hill. And I took two shots, one with the focus on the first mountain and one with the focus on the second mountain. And that's the way prophets used to prophesy. Sometimes they'd talk to the people of their day, the closer mountain. And sometimes they talk to the people in the last days. That would be us. And sometimes there are even multiple fulfillments. So they might talk, for instance, Isaiah tells us that a baby will be born from a virgin, and that will be a miracle and an oath, a sign. Now, the people of Isaiah's day looked at that and said, how is that a sign? So Isaiah's friends then said, well, what does that have to do with us? And there was a fulfillment in the next year when Isaiah's, the baby was born from a lady who was a virgin at the time of the announcement. Okay, so that was a present tense fulfillment. But then there's a future fulfillment, and we know that from the biblical narrative when Jesus was born of a virgin, and that would be the second fulfillment of that same prediction. Do you understand how that works? So this is a classic picture that you would use to understand what Bible interpreters call multiple fulfillments. First, in view, out of view, but later in view.
What's the thing that does it in the vision?
It's an oracle. It's a vision. It's his seeing. It's this burden.
With his eyes?
Nobody knows how a vision is seen by visionaries, whether it is something that they see written on a wall or they see in their mind's eye, that's commonly the way that people describe it, or whether they were asleep and they kind of were in a dream state. Those are often in Bible called dreams, not visions. So a vision is something that he sees that no one else sees, that is somehow clear to him but nobody else sees, and he communicates. It's sometimes translated as burden or oracle, and that means it's something I understand, I've got to let it out. So we're looking at the vision that at once might encompass a broad period of time. Visions that prophets were given are not restricted to a thin slice of time, but sometimes encompass a very expansive one. That's especially evident in some of the messianic prophecies, where events from both the first and second comings of Messiah are communicated in one prophetic scene. That certainly was true in Zechariah chapter 9. I don't know if Paul will touch touch on that next week, but it was something that riveted me when I went to my rabbi and took him my King James Bible, and he said here, and showed me the two scenes, the two visitations of Messiah in one chapter. In Obadiah, a very broad chronological perspective is portrayed all the way from back to the time of the destruction of the first temple through to the time of our times, the time of the end. The indictment contains charges of crimes at various points along the way, just like the Queensland Acts require. Some may be tempted to relegate the scope of the prophecy to only the ancients, but given the future scope of some portions, it's clear it applies to modern Edomites as well. Even as it says, on that day in verse 11, and the day, verse 15, of the Lord draws near on all the nations. This is not only the moment that Obadiah is talking, but for all time. The most compelling scriptural evidence to identify the Edomites is found in Ezekiel chapter 36, verse number 5. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, surely in the fire of my jealousy I've spoken against the rest of the nations and against all Edom, who appropriated my land for themselves as a possession with wholehearted joy and with scorn of soul to drive it out for a prey. Kol Levav, with all their heart. The kind of way we're supposed to serve God, according to the book of Deuteronomy. And the reason judgment comes on the Jewish people is because we don't serve God, but Kol Levav, with all our heart. So here it is, on all of Edom, the Al Edom Kula, on all of Edom. This is not only speaking about the Edom of the day, but all Edom who would come from Edom. Edom is Esau, Jacob's brother. There are some who argue that the Idumeans, from whom came Herod, actually controlled Jerusalem at the time, and even what we call the West Bank. And as a result, the West Bank is part of the controversy. And I'll show you what they say when we get to that part here in the text. The maps of early Bible days show Edom in the south, but by the time of Yeshua, Edom had sprawled north to include West Bank. Look, there are allusions to events as varied as the destruction of the temples, and some point to the Islamic seizure of the Temple Mount, to Arab complicity in the Nazi Holocaust, to Palestinian terrorism, to the destruction of the Muslim power base in Saudi Arabia, modern Syria, what's going on today in the newspaper, and to Iran, who boasted yesterday about the possibility they have of nuclear fuel rods, that they can do that. So we'll see. Who are the Edomites in modern setting? The first 15 verses of Ezekiel 36 give God's viewpoint to the preeminent issue of our day, the ownership of what's called the West Bank. Verse 5 describes a conspiracy between the nations of the world and Edom to misappropriate that land that God had granted to the Jewish people. Therefore, we can conclude that Edom, in the modern context, is West Bank Palestinians. That's not what was in view in Obadiah's day, because he was looking first at that first mountain. We, way down the track, 2,500 years on, are looking at the Edom of our day, West Bank Palestinians.
What about the ones in Gaza, the Edom?
No, those were Philistines. So if we get to a prophecy about Philistines, that would include them. If we are geographically bound, here's the problem. If we say, well, let's talk about people from Singapore. Sometimes we mean people who geographically live in the land of Singapore. Sometimes we're meaning Ezra and others who were born in Singapore but who've lived around the globe. You talk about Chinese, you're talking about Chinese who live in China, or you're talking about Chinese who've spread around the world. Chileans, British, American. You get the idea. Sometimes we're talking about the geography. So Philistia is Gaza. Sometimes we're talking about Philistines who traveled, who moved around. They were ship people, so they moved on ships. They might be in Crete or in Cyprus. So we got to be careful. But I think Edom in the text has to do with all Edomites wherever they are and the geography. Large chunks of Obadiah are repeated in Jeremiah chapter 49. So you can have a read of that later. Actual citations. As Jeremiah prophesies against Edom. He just takes it verbatim. Look, when portions are repeated almost exactly the way they were, it's probably significant, probably a reinforcement of the importance of that message. And it makes sense to me that Jeremiah is quoting Obadiah, not Obadiah quoting Jeremiah. Why would Obadiah quote Jeremiah and not quote whole chunks? It's probably that Obadiah predated Jeremiah. That helps us understand his time. He's a minor prophet. We looked at Jonah before. He's a minor prophet, but only minor in the sense of not written a lot, not in the sense of unimportant. So in Jeremiah, Edom and other neighbors of Israel are addressed. They include Jordan, Syria, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, with prophecies of their future punishment. The core of the indictment, though, is here a sevenfold accusation. Verse 12 to 14 of Obadiah. Don't rejoice over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Don't rejoice over the sons of Judah, the day of their destruction. Yeah, don't boast in the day of their distress. Don't enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Don't gloat over their calamity, day of their disaster. Don't loot their wealth, day of their disaster. You get the idea? Here's the sevenfold charge that's come on the Edomites. You should not have, or do not have, or don't, at the beginning of each charge, combined with on the day of their disaster, gives the effect of a pounding jackhammer. Calvin says this again. And the reason why this prophecy is leveled against the Idumeans only is this, that they, as we know, raged more cruelly than any others against the Israelites. For it is not said without a cause in Psalm 137, quote, remember the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem who said, make bare, even to the very foundation. So if the psalmist wrote this, and Obadiah, between the psalmist and Jeremiah, write this, and Jeremiah cites this, Edom was a major player in global history and Jewish history for hundreds of years in opposition to the Jews and in hostility to them, to us. So here's the final charge in verse 14. Don't stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives. Don't imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. When, during a terrible time for the Jewish people, a time of death, were the Arabs accomplices of the agents of death by not allowing Jews to come to their place of refuge? In 1920s, early 20s, 1922, immigration basically stopped. Worldwide. America led the charge, apologies, and many other countries stopped. And from 1881, when the Pale of Settlement broke up in Belarusia, until 1922, massive numbers of Jews left. Your family left and went to Ireland. Your family left and went to Romania. Jews left everywhere and went everywhere in those days, got out of the former Soviet Union. It was a massive time of transfer of Jewish people to Kitchnev and to England and to France, Italy, and Chile and Australia. It was a massive, to Greece, to America, to all over. But in 1922, while the British were sorting out how to carve up the Middle East along with the French after World War I, immigration stopped. And Jews were sort of stuck where they were. And a lot of it in the Middle East itself, certainly in Israel, or then called Palestine, was foisted on the world by some Arabic hostile peoples against Jewish migration into the land of Israel. In the 1930s and 40s, Jewish people faced the worst crises of our modern history, to be sure. At the same time, the Lord was opening doors to go back to Israel through the Zionist activity, but the British heartlessly slammed the doors shut at the most crucial time, primarily because of the influence of the Arabs. Not all Arabs, mind you. Please don't have a hostility towards all Arabs. That makes no sense. But towards Arabic leaders who saw what truly came to pass. Succumbing to political pressure and physical duress, the British people did not allow Jews to enter back into their land. You remember the story of the Exodus, so famous. Abandoning the Jewish people to mass death in Europe under the Nazi regime. Had it not been for Arab rioting and violence, the British would not have enacted those policies, perhaps. Therefore, Edom was responsible for killing those at the escape routes, at the fork of the road in verse 14. Obadiah's repetitive emphasis on the day of their disaster seems evocative of the Holocaust. It's hard for us post-Holocaust not to see that throughout this. Now, in 1901, they wouldn't have said the Holocaust. They would have said, well, look what's happening because of this, that, and the other thing. A little pogrom in Russia or Poland. All right, those things happen. But Edom wasn't involved in those days. After 1930, for sure they were. Though the Nazis are seriously responsible. We're not going to let them off the hook at all. The Palestinians were accessories and accomplices. Palestinian leader Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the Mufti of Jerusalem, was the notorious agitator of violence against Palestinian Jews in the 20s and 30s. And if you read the books, I don't carry them, and if you want, I'll get them in for you. It's an historical, romantic novel series, two different series, series, both 6 books long, by a woman named Bodhi Taney, T-H-O-E-N-E. And Bodhi Taney has written the Zion Covenant series and the Zion Chronicle series. They're novels, like I say, and they are historically informed. And you'll see the Mufti, and you'll see Hitler, and you'll see...
Didn't the Mufti mean a deal with Hitler?
Yeah, there was conspiracy galore. Here, we'll dress a Jew up like this, said al-Hussein, and we'll do some things dastardly so that we Palestinians can go after them. Mind you, I use the word Palestinian in modern times. That's not what they were called in those days. So that we can go do retribution against them. And Bodhi Taney and her books chronicle those very accurately. They're good reads. It's Hollywood, to be fair. There are people she puts in there that don't exist, but it allows her to tell the story. Al-Husseini played no small part in the Holocaust. He lived in Berlin during the war, became chummy with Hitler. Husseini worked together with him on various efforts. We're not going to go through it all, but it's well documented, including the development of a Bosnian Muslim division of the SS that Husseini personally recruited for Hitler. Recalling that Obadiah takes a long view of Edom's crimes over time, we understand that the brutal mistreatment of the Jews is not new. It's not a recent reality. Verse number 13 says, "Don't enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster, yet don't gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster." The extended calamity when Israel was expelled back in 70 CE ended with the Holocaust, when we were allowed to get back in. God takes issue with the way that Jacob's relative gloated, plundered, and looted during the time of his exile. According to God, Israel never relinquished ownership of the land, even after 2,000 years. The Palestinians, who even today continue to make illegitimate claim to Israel's property, are guilty of pillaging what they do not rightfully own. As it says in verse 13, "Don't loot their wealth in the day of their disaster." Monday night this week, I was interviewed for a Christian TV show by my friend Rommel Gossein, who's an Arabic-speaking Jesus lover and a good mate. And if you can find some videos on Jews for Jesus website, you'll find 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, because we do them in packages of 3. You'll find some that Rommel has done, and he sends me the YouTube and we put it up on our website. Great interview. He's a good interviewer. And he asked me this week specifically about the Temple Mount. This was a big deal because it's a big deal in the news, because it was probably 1995 was one of the big times when a fellow named Baruch Goldstein shot the prime minister.
Yeah.
Yitzhak Rabin, and killed him November 4th, 1995. A Jew kills another Jew because Rabin was ready to give away the Temple Mount. Okay, we didn't own it. Goldstein was one of the temple faithful. He was one of the radicals that wanted to get the Jews to own the upstairs, if you will, there at the temple, and to recapture it. My friend Rommel asked me, "Do I think that it will ever be regained?" I said, "There's prophecy that it will." Whether that meant back in Second Temple time or this temple time, no one is so sure, although I think I put in here that, unlike my friend Paul Cohen, who will speak next week on Zechariah, I think Yeshua could come back any day, before or after the temple is built, before or after the mount is secured from the Muslims who run the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Let God be God, and let our charts be a fable and a testimony to our own ignorance. That said, however, here's a list of several detailed characteristics of the Edomites that match current Muslim Palestinians. Number 1, verse 10, the slaughter and violence against the Jewish people. You see it? Against the brother Jacob. Shame comes on us, covers us, and we're cut off forever. You will be cut off forever, not Jews. Because of the murderous history compiled against your brother Jacob, is there a more fitting description than slaughter and violence for the way the rocks are thrown, the Scud missiles are shot, the constant harassment and the saber rattling that Iran, Syria, Saudi, and the Muslim Brotherhood down in Egypt are going to be doing against Israel? It's not a surprise that God has this as a title for them. Number 2, celebrating the disasters, verse 2. Verse 12, don't rejoice, don't gloat in the day of their distress. This is exactly what happened. Remember in the Palestinian press, Al Jazeera, when they showed 9/11, the terrible tragedy of 2,700 people dying in New York City, 2 fell swoops. And they showed in Al Jazeera, and we saw it worldwide, people rejoicing and shouting, hooraying, because Jews were in those buildings. And they were rejoicing over the destruction of real people. They were gloating in the day of the distress of Jews. Whether it was all Jews, which of course it wasn't, at the World Trade Center, it was just Westernism. But even today, many Palestinians praised the Holocaust, wishing Hitler had finished the job. Number 3, there are nine, by the way, of these. Number three, comparisons. Handing over Jewish survivors in the day of their trouble, verse 14, they did this in the 30s and 40s, forcing the British to enact laws of very little immigration during the British mandate. Number four, verse 13, don't enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Palestinians took possession of land not theirs, including the Old City, for a time. Not till 1967 did the Jews recapture the Old City. Number five, exhibiting an excessive arrogance. Look at verses 2 and 4. I'll make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart deceived you. You say in your heart, who's going to bring me down to earth? You build high like the eagle. Eagle was, by the way, a Palestinian. Well, so many. Romans did it. Americans did it. Everybody uses an eagle except for the Aussies, who use a kangaroo and an emu. But this idea of excessive arrogance makes them despised by people all over the world. Number six, like an eagle in verse 4. That's the emblem of the Palestinian Authority. Number seven, verse 16. Pardon me for jumping around a fair bit. Because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They'll drink and swallow and become as if they'd never existed. They're rejoicing. They're reveling on the Holy Temple Mount. Islamic preachers in the mosque there consistently spew out the worst kind of anti-Jew hate speech in their Friday sermons. Number 8, in verse 21, this is the summary. The deliverers will ascend Har Zion, Mount Zion, to judge the mountain of Esau. Har Zion, quoted Har Esav. The mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. Something symbolically called Mount Esau up on the Temple Mount. The structures there that represent the power of the Islamic deity, who, by the way, is not God. Although, here's a thing that a lot of people try to work on. You know, we as Jews work on translating the Bible, New Testament, to Jewish people. We try to help Jewish people sort out who Yeshua is. Try to help them see that he's the Messiah, the Savior, died for our sins, rose from the dead. And we want to make that something that's ethno-sensitive, that Jewish people will understand. So we talk about, why do we say Trinity? We talk about, well, Elohim might be a way to help you understand that. It's multiple, it's at least three. It can't be two. That'd be Elohim. So it's at least three, yet one. So we talk about it in those terms. In the same way, Muslim evangelists, that is, evangelists who are from a Muslim background, they're called MBBs, Muslim Background Believers, try to share the faith of Yeshua, or Isa, with Muslims. And so they might use the word Allah to explain to a Muslim that we're talking about God. Before they go on to the God of the Bible, who is disparate as all get out from Allah, they will use the term Allah to help a Muslim. It's not a deception. It's just using standard terminology. We call it the law of a perception. A perception. That's one word. A double P. And it means start with what someone knows before you go to what they don't know. Start with Genesis before you get to Jeremiah. Start with Jeremiah before you get to Saint Matthew. Start with Matthew and parables before you get to the book of the Revelation. It just makes sense. Start with level one or year two before you get to year three and year nine. That's the way life is. Progressive revelation. That is, we start with what we know, we're revealed, we get it, we take it on board, and then we move on. I did arithmetic before I did geometry, before I did calculus. So that's what he says here, that the power of the Islamic deity, that's Allah, is represented in this Mount Esau. Number nine of nine. Israel is finally going to recover the territory from them. That's verses 19 and 20. And he describes all the different places where our Jews for Jesus campaigns are being held throughout Israel. We've had six already, and we have six more to go. And there are several places right here. In verse 9, your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, so that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. Teman is an actual word, an actual place. It means literally southward. Some people say that it is associated with Medina, the city of Muhammad in Saudi Arabia, and that it doesn't matter that the historical connection is shaky. What matters is the Muslims themselves make the connection between Teman and Medina. So this reinforces even more the idea that this verse is referring to the Saudi Arabians, to the Saudis, and to the power of Islam itself. Recall Mount Esau is apparently Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, so let me propose a paraphrase to verse 10. Your mighty allies in the south, the Saudis, will be broken and every man will be cut off from Al-Aqsa. Well, it is indeed the Arab Muslims who've seized the Temple Mount. They've prolonged violence against their brother Jacob. Look at verse 10. What's the Hebrew word for violence here? Because of the violence to your brother Jacob. Mechamas. From the Hamas. That's the word violence. It's a Hebrew word. It's the same in Arabic. So Hamas is anything but a peaceful agency. Obadiah did not know what he was saying, that Hamas of the 1970s and 80s and 90s was going to actually play out the condemnation by God on Edom. It's not just Islam that will be the object of God's judgment. It's the entire rebellious world. Look at verse number 15. It says, you and everybody on all the nations, as you've done, it'll be done to you, your dealings, all the nations will drink continually. They'll drink and swallow and be wiped out completely. Notice the emphasis on the Temple Mount, my holy mountain. Yeah, you can't miss it, because this is the place where God indicated his name would dwell forever in the Psalms. Obadiah is a marvelous recitation of very specific geographic promises to Israel. I see it ultimately, Obadiah is a message of recovery, restoration, and royal reign. Recovery of the place where God has for us, and we will see this in every prophet. There's trouble on the nation. There might be trouble within the nation of Israel. There is a hope, and it comes through an agent of hope. We know him as Messiah. And then the deliverer will be there, and look, the final word, the kingdom will be the Lord's. That's when it all wraps up. That's what it's going to be about. The summary, just what we find in the book of the Revelation, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Messiah, and he shall reign forever and ever. Look, that's the summary. That's Obadiah. It's only 21 verses. It's chock full of things for the day and things of our day. Obadiah, of course, comes from two Hebrew words, Eved and Yah, servant of Yahweh. And he is just like Moses, who brought the law to the Jewish people, who was also called the servant of the Lord. One final comment. I want to thank Bob Westbrook, whose commentary on this little book was significantly helpful in my study today.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.